Hey everyone, you're about to listen to the fifth episode of the Gustav Baller Show about the Second Viennese School and the composers Schoenberg, Berg, and Webern. In the cold, hard, sober light of the morning, I realized there was a few things we forgot to say. First, that if you like the show, consider checking out patreon.com/Gustav Baller. There's a new $3 a month subscription tier, which is the lowest Patreon recommends. And also check out Zazzle.com/Gustav Baller Shop. Two t-shirt designs up there, one with the classic GBS logo and one with the It's Mahler Time logo. Yeah, thanks so much for checking the show out, and we really hope you enjoy this episode. Bye. And that's the beginning of the Power Hour. That's how we're doing things today. Because we're an episode... Oh, sorry, I got a drink. Hold on a sec. Okay. Welcome back to episode 5 of the Gustav Baller Show. Today, Nick and I are joined by a good friend, Kenzie. Kenzie, say what's up.
Hello, what's up?
Hey, it's so good to see you. So nice to have you here.
Hi, Kenzie.
It's great to be here.
Oh, shit. I also forgot that every time... Okay. Oh, shit. This is time sensitive. But today we're talking about the Second Viennese School. So I'm drinking German beer, even though it's not from Austria, and doing a power hour with it. And every time I open a new beer, I'm going to have an Underberg, which is like the German for... Oh, shit. Okay. Okay. Back on track. I'm really sorry to all the listeners who complained that there was too much burping on the first episode. This episode might have too much burping. I'm sorry. Anyways, yeah, like I said, today we're talking about the Second Viennese School. The Second Viennese School are the composers Schoenberg, Berg, and Webern. They're called the Second Viennese School to distinguish them from the First Viennese School, which was Mozart, Beethoven, and Haydn, which was the late 18th century, early 19th century. Here we're dealing with the period from, like, let's say, like, 1900 to the mid-1920s or so, even though Schoenberg lived quite a deal longer.
Oh, wow.
Okay, I forgot about this. Kenzie, the first segment of every show is apologies. And I actually do have something to apologize for.
All right, let's hear it. Week.
And Nick, I want to apologize to you.
Oh, really?
For saying that no one wanted to follow you on TikTok in the last episode.
Oh, it's okay.
It was really rude. It's not okay. It was really rude. And in fact, you make great TikToks. I still use your coffee recipe. All your recipes on there are so good. Your saxophone playing is so good. I was just jealous that you're such your creativity knows no bounds.
That is maybe one of the best all-time apologies that you've given me, Max, and I greatly appreciate it. And
I've had to give a lot of apologies to you.
I know. And to be fair, I've given my fair share of apologies to you. And I have one. Oh shit, here we go.
Oh, you don't have to do that if you don't want to.
Okay.
But if you do want to, you're welcome.
Well, I have to apologize because I think I'm pretty sure I threatened to kill you almost every episode at some point toward the end. Oh.
But that's okay. I get it. I threatened to do that to myself all the time.
Okay. Fair enough.
We're all fine.
Everyone listening knows Nick. Kenzie is a dear friend of mine. We played a lot together in Potsdam, New York. I forced her to play the Strauss Violin Sonata. I forced her to play the Berg Violin Concerto. A lot of forcings in this friendship. But I would say it worked out great for me. and that's what matters. And anyways, I hope it worked out for you too,
Kendra. No, it also worked out for me because then you played all my other shitty pieces for free, so that was the point. And I got introduced to some really great music too. Like, if I didn't know Strauss or Berg, I don't even know who I would be today.
Yeah. That's fair. All right, so the three composers in the Second Viennese School are Schoenberg, Arnold Schoenberg, Alban Berg, and Anton Webern. They are grouped together because Berg and Webern were students of Schoenberg. They wrote in similar styles. But I think in order to talk about their styles, I want to give a really quick and really reductive overview of, like, the history of Western classical music. Like, such a reductive history that if anyone listening to this was ever on my, like, tenure board, they would not give me tenure. But basically, an argument could be made that the history of literate Western music is the history of how dissonances are treated. Music notation was invented in order so that the church could have, like, unified music in all its services, like, all over the Holy Roman Empire. They needed a way to do that, so notation was invented. At first, there were, like, no dissonances. There was one voice, and then there were two voices, and the rules were really strict, and then counterpoint got more dissonances, but the rules were still pretty strict. And the dissonance that we're talking about mostly is the tritone and how chords with a tritone resolve to other chords. And by the time of the late 19th century, like, oh shit. Mahler, Wagner, and who's the third? I was thinking there were three composers who pushed tonality to the limits. Oh, Liszt, I think. So Mahler, Wagner, and Liszt had basically pushed tonality to its furthest reaches where it couldn't really make sense anymore. And Schoenberg came along and he pretty much said, like, okay, any dissonance is fine. We can, there's no more rules about dissonances anymore. This is what the music history has been leading towards. He called it the emancipation of the dissonance, and I think he even compared himself to Abraham Lincoln at one point. Schoenberg thought so highly of himself, he compared freeing the dissonance with the freeing of slaves in the rebelling southern states. Okay. That sound about right to you guys? You guys got anything to add to that?
Yeah.
No, super accurate.
Because one of the points that Schoenberg always made isn't that he was a revolutionary composer, but he was an evolutionary composer. And he felt very strongly that he was just taking music to its next logical conclusion. Yeah. Kenzie, do you got anything about Schoenberg?
Schoenberg? No, not really. Like, he seems like a cool guy. Like, analyze a lot of stuff. He blew a lot of shit up, which I respect.
Yeah. What Max, could I ask you a question? Or Kenzie?
Yeah.
What is serialism?
Oh, serialism. Oh. Nick. Nick just said the word serialism. Serialism is a compositional tool which we can pretty much date back to Schoenberg. So what made Schoenberg so famous, I would make the argument that as Beethoven was to the 19th century, Schoenberg is to the 20th century.
Okay.
And I think it was Alan Shawn, this musicologist, who said that Schoenberg is a composer who's defended and not listened to, which is true because we learn about him in school and people, like, he's in the history books, but no one ever fucking plays his music.
Right.
Like, no major orchestra ever does it. No opera houses do it. No chamber groups do it. So serialism was a new So what Schoenberg is known for was the invention of, he didn't like that people called it 12-tone composition. He wanted it referred to as composition with 12 tones. And what that means is that no tone reigns supreme. There's no tonic where there's no tone that the piece starts and ends on. Each note is equal. And in really strict 12-tone music, in really strict serial music, like you use all 12 notes before you start repeating notes that you've previously played. Okay. And this had a huge impact on 20th century music. And people, so Schoenberg serialized pitches. Other composers figured out how to serialize dynamics, how to serialize rhythms. Mm-hmm. And then, so, like, this is, like, later Messiaen and Boulez would do these things, and that's referred to as total serialism. But what we're talking about with Schoenberg is 12-tone music, and I think the word is dodecaphony, but that's basically serialism. Like, a plan by which all 12 notes are used in a really specific order. Yeah. And so there's like the prime order, and then there's a reverse order, there's an inverted order, and then there's a reverse of the inversion. And then the composer will take that matrix of tones and create the piece out of it. I don't know. How do you define serialism, Nick?
So just to be clear.
Oh yeah.
It's not serial. I got all psyched for this episode. I got my Honey Nut Cheerios here. But just to be completely clear for our listeners, we're not talking about cereal. Like, we're not talking about the breakfast food. For me, it's a junk food, and I like cereal when it's crunchy. So I don't like it with milk. I just like it dry. I know it's fucked up, right? I'm one of those really bad, you know, habits. Dry cereal. No. So going back to the cerealism with an S, I like it because, it is, like you said, the next, like, logical place for tonality. And I think at this point in, like, Western music, like, you know, we were exiting the Romantic era, and there's kind of, like, this standard performance practice. People are playing their instruments really good. You know, people are really, like, virtuosic. You know what I mean? I think if this music was written in, like, the Baroque era, it would have a different sound just naturally because of the way it was performed. Like, it would probably be played really out of tune. This music demands like a really high level of musicianship. It demands focus. And it's like, there's a certain intensity on when you are watching performers play Schoenberg or Webern or Berg or something like that, or something where you have to really be so aware, not only of like your own like performance on your instrument, but of rhythm and time. Things don't develop in the same natural organic way as like a piece like by you know, a more traditional composer. But that's not to say that Schoenberg's music isn't always non-traditional. Like as a performance practice, like you still approach it with the same kind of attention to detail that you'd approach any classical piece.
And I always feel like when I play atonal or serially music, it's more important to, like, I frankly don't care what Beethoven or Mozart wanted. Mm-hmm. And it's easier to fake it. If you play wrong notes, or like, it's easier to change the notes in a chord. So like you're playing maybe the same harmony, but not the notes they wrote or something like that. But when I play serial music, like, I feel like I'm taking advantage of the audience if I don't like play it absolutely perfectly. Because even as a trained musician, this music is really hard to tell like when the notes are right or wrong, right? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like if I sat down, if I went to a concert and they were playing Schoenberg, I would have no idea if there were wrong notes in the performance. And so I feel like there's a heavier burden on the performer to do things correctly in this style than in like classical style, where there's more room for like, more room for error, or like being able to trick it, you know what I mean?
I think like for me, I actually had the opposite, where I felt like I had more leeway with expression because of the absence of tonality. So because tonality wasn't a factor, as long as like the expressionism was there and like I was able to like do the dynamics or like feel if I had an F sharp or F natural, I didn't feel like it really mattered. Whereas if you do the same thing when you're playing Beethoven, like if you're playing something in Beethoven in G, like if you hit an F sharp or an F natural, it really fucking matters.
Yeah, that's true.
But so I think like for me, the lack of tonality was somewhat freeing, because you could just focus on the other stuff.
Oh,
that's cool. That's a really nice way to think of it that I frankly never have.
Also, I have a question, Kenzie, like if you're playing a piece like that on violin, that's atonal or just like lacking traditional harmonic structures, like you might get to like, let's say an F sharp and a D chord. In Beethoven, you might be like just edge a little lower on the F sharp, right? And then on, but if it's not that same kind of like major chord structure, you might be have more leeway to play it on like a, with a slightly different approach. Is that, am I understanding that right?
I think for when I learn atonal music, I stick with equal temperament. So that's when I really pull out my tuner and I just do the grind. You know?
Yeah.
Oh, do you tune your violin differently based on what repertoire you're playing?
No, you don't. Your fingers tune. Your strings stay the same. But
okay.
Like if you're playing in an orchestra versus a string quartet, you play a little bit different. Versus when you're playing with piano, like you have to play equal temperament because your pianist is equal temperament. Whereas when you're playing in a string quartet, you might like edge that leading tone up a little bit.
Right.
So,
I see.
Yeah.
Cool.
That's cool.
So I my job today was to talk about Schoenberg, and I have a couple quotes from some books I want to read. Oh my god damn. okay, the burps might be annoying, that those beeps might be really annoying, but one of the constant complaints I've got about this show is that no one knows when we're drinking. So this is a really annoying solution to a problem that's probably easier to solve than I think. Anyways. Kenzie.
I know, just... I put my phone on silent and then it still made a noise. I'm sorry.
Max, you're serializing your drinking, just like Schoenberg would do.
Nick.
See, it all comes back to the cereal. That's why I've got all these Honey Nut Cheerios.
So are you for real that... So say you wake up in the morning and you want breakfast, but you're too lazy to cook eggs or something. You will just fucking have a bowl of dry cereal?
Yeah, is that so crazy?
I used to do that in like, that was like my snack when I was like after school. I would put, Honey Nut Cheerios in like a mug and then I would just snack on those or Lucky Charms too.
Yeah, epic. It's like a snack.
Yeah, it's a snack.
It's an epic snack. It's like a peanut. You never have a peanut? You tell me you don't have a peanut every now and then?
I have peanuts, but peanuts aren't associated with milk.
You know, why you have to be drinking milk? Oh, you know, you can just enjoy cereal as it is. We don't need
You're
to
hung
add
up
like
on
an
the
extra
milk.
Liquid. Yeah.
Okay. Because I know the audience of this podcast, I'm really afraid for you guys that for this hot take, you're gonna get doxxed. Your address is
posted. I'm ready to be canceled because then maybe no one will bother me ever again. So yes, internet fucking cancel me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Oh, Jesus.
Oh, my God.
Arnold Schoenberg. Born in Austria, 1874 to 1951. Lived a long-ass time.
Old-ass motherfucker.
Old-ass motherfucker. He was Jewish. That has a lot to do with being in Vienna at this time. That had a big influence on his life, obviously. He escaped to America, lived in Hollywood. It's really funny. He and Stravinsky were like the two faces of musical modernism, and they hated each other. And then they both moved to Hollywood, and I'm pretty sure they were like next-door neighbors. But they never talk to each other.
Well, there's no business like show business.
And Schoenberg actually was the first person to say that.
Are you serious?
Yeah, was he? Wasn't it that one like Broadway musical song? There's no business like show business.
Yeah, but where did they get it? It's possible Schoenberg said it.
It's possible. It's possible.
Okay, like I said earlier, he invented the 12-tone system. He has basically three style periods, much like we group Beethoven to style periods. Mm. And I'm going to start with his late period. This is the strictly 12-tone music, the theory that he's known for and the theory that had crazy influence over the 20th century. The pieces you want to check for here are like... the piano pieces, Opus 33A and 33B, I think. Oh my God, I need another beer already. Hold on a sec. You guys talk about Schoenberg for a minute. I gotta go get another beer.
Oh, okay. All right. So Kenzie.
Yeah, Schoenberg. Yeah. Well, Max and I played Perio Lunaire, which is a very famous Schoenberg piece.
Yes.
Together, and I played violin and viola. Not well.
Sick.
nice. But we did do it in a concert.
That's awesome. That's
really cool. Yeah, there are a lot of... Yeah.
Did you like that playing that piece?
It was an interesting experience. Mm-hmm. I would say our vocalists learned a lot. And vocalists, if you're listening, like, no shade. But they learned a lot about rhythm. And how important that is when you're doing an ensemble.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and our conductor was a little crazy. Yeah, that was, I think...
Piero? Who was your conductor?
Yeah. It was...
you know him, the flute professor at Crane.
Yeah, KBA. Kenneth B. Andrews. Yes.
Speaking of canceled.
Yeah, Ken, if you're listening, I sincerely enjoyed working with you a lot, even if you were problematic.
Sorry. It's a new beer for me, which means another Underberg down the hatch. You're supposed to drink Underberg after a big meal, and I have had a shit ton of chips and French onion dip.
Mm. That counts.
So it is helping.
That counts.
Okay, anyways, the 12-tone period, Opus 33A, 33B, the piano concerto. Mm. I think, whatever. Then you guys were talking about PROs, so that's the like early atonal... stuff, right?
Yes.
Did you talk about that? Okay, so anyways. when we're in music school and we study Schoenberg, this is the music that we're exposed to. The atonal music, or the 12-tone music and the free atonal music. By free atonal, I mean music that is... doesn't have a tonal center, but isn't like rigidly structured as the 12-tone music was. These are like his early experimentations in 12-tone music. This is like the piano pieces, Opus 11. He was really involved with expressionism, like through all the arts right now at this time. So there's Erwartung, this opera for soprano and orchestra. There are the five pieces for orchestra in which he... invented something called Klangfarben melody, which means tone color melody. And the idea was that you could make a melody not out of the relationship of pitch to pitch sequence, but from like tone color and instrument in the orchestra sequenced. And this music sounds pretty awesome. And in here, I'm going to insert a clip of like, I don't know, some atonal piano music. And then let's pretend we just listened to it. Wow, that was really good.
Ooh,
stuff.
Yeah.
Amazing.
That's what you love to hear.
Never heard anything like it.
And, okay, so, I mean, we didn't just listen to it, but Nick, I think you and I have talked about this before. We're like, that music still sounds so new and so fresh.
Yeah.
Because to me, it sounds somehow like it's prehistoric. Like, It'll never sound, like, quote-unquote good to us. It has this, like, otherworldly sort of sound to it. I don't know. What do you think?
I agree. I think it's kind of cool that it doesn't have, like music that's over 100 years old can sound so new, right?
Yeah.
It's, like, really old. How is that a thing? How does that happen? Like, other music that's 100 years old sounds 100 years old. You know what I mean?
That, and also, like, it's easier to date other music. Like, minimalism, you can date to 60s and 70s. Like, the 80s pop music, like, there's no way it could be from any other time in the 80s. You know, like, this, like, atonal Schoenberg music sounds a little bit like caveman music or something. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But then what's really fascinating to me is, like, the first time you go to music, the first time, like, you take a class in music school and they show you the early romantic Schoenberg music. And here I'm going to insert a clip of Gurlieder or Verklärungsnacht. So let's take a listen to Verklärungsnacht. Gurlieder. Wow. That was awesome.
Amazing. And incredible.
Yeah, really amazing.
Dude. Can't believe.
And here, I want to read a quote from Schoenberg. So he, like, really felt a historic, like, it was his responsibility to be this person in history that would write this atonal, ugly music that no one really liked. But he felt a really strong sense of duty, and I don't know, it's potentially misguided. Like, there are plenty of other ways that music could have gone. It's a little bit like begging the question that it had to be this way, and it had to be atonal and 12-tone.
Mm-hmm.
But he wrote this article in 1937 called How One Becomes Lonely, which is so sad. And they're talking... Verklärungsnacht and Gurlieder were really popular when he was alive. And he says, this work has been heard, especially in its version for orchestra, a great many times, but certainly nobody has heard it as often as I have heard this complaint. Quote, if only he had continued to compose in this style. The answer I give is perhaps surprising. I said, quote, I have not discontinued composing in the same style and in the same way as at the very beginning. The difference is only that I do it better now than before. It is more concentrated, more mature. And that has to do with him believing he was an evolutionary composer and not a revolutionary composer. Like, he really thought that this was, like, the next logical step.
Right.
You guys say something. I talk too much.
I wonder, like, what is another way it could have gone? What's an alternative reality to Schoenberg, you know?
But then I think... Oh, go ahead, Kenzie.
Oh, I was thinking about, like the French school, too, and, like, what they were doing during the time of Schoenberg, which was completely different, like, Impressionism.
Completely different.
Yeah,
and what Schoenberg said about them was either what we do is music or what the French do is music. They can't both be music.
Well, yeah, because they were... French nationality was at its peak then because they just had that major war where it was just like, should we think about French music or should we imitate what the Germans are doing? And so the French people with Debussy decided to do that French thing. So, yeah, I feel like that's the alternate reality is when, like, French music actually, like, made a difference in tonality.
Yeah, that
wasn't meant to be shady.
It's okay. You can talk shit about the French.
No, I mean, I think German composers around that time really liked that they were German composers around that time. You know what I mean?
Yeah. What's really interesting about Debussy's case is that he was a huge Wagner head when he was young. Like, he wanted to be the French Wagner, but then he soured on him. And, like, good looks, because the music he writes after he hates Wagner is awesome. Like, Debussy's great.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess that's a pretty good overview of Schoenberg. I think I mentioned, well, oh. One thing I really would like to discuss is, Nick, I know you love this music.
Uh-huh.
I know you love atonal and 12-tone music.
Yeah.
Kenzie, I don't exactly know where you stand on it. I would love to know, like, why you like it and why you think we should listen to it. And just real quick, I do want to read one quote from Adorno. He wrote this book called Philosophy of New Music, which was like a Schoenberg versus Stravinsky thing. I mentioned earlier they were enemies, they hated each other, and they were, that was like, that was the like 20th century dialectic. Schoenberg or Stravinsky. And so this is Adorno saying, he's saying, I think he's talking about people in the public. Okay, I'm just reading the quote. Adorno is a known, like, elitist about classical music and stuff, so take this with a grain of salt.
Mm-hmm.
When they think they comprehend the music, they only perceive an inert, empty husk of what they treasure as possession and what was already lost in the moment in which it became a possession. An indifferent showpiece neutralized and robbed of its own critical substance. In fact, all that the public grasps of traditional music is its crudest aspects, easily remembered themes, ominously beautiful passages, moods, and associations. For the listener trained to the sound of radio, the musical nexus that establishes meaning is no less hidden in an early Beethoven sonata than in a Schoenberg quartet, which at least reminds the listener that he is not in heaven, brought to graze on sweet tones. Shit, that took a minute. I'm sorry.
That's heavy. Yeah.
Every fucking minute.
Yeah. So Nick, and Kenzie, you too. Like, do you think it's worthwhile to listen to this music? What do you like about it? What do you dislike about it?
Here's why I like it. And this is especially why I like Webern's music. I feel like it like demands repeat listening, right? And it demands you to like really spend time with it, even if it's a really short piece, you know. Which is interesting. I feel like Webern, who is the guy I was going to talk about, his music is. It's interesting for somebody like Webern to develop before, like, recording technology existed. His music wants to be recorded, right? His music was barely heard at concerts and in public, right? So no wonder why nobody really understood it, because nobody could like go away from a Webern show and be like, oh, okay, I know what he was doing. I know what he was, you know, he's swinging cat, you know, he ain't, you know,
right.
I mean, he's not blowing changes up there.
But what's really funny is that was the complaint against Mahler also.
Oh, interesting.
But on the opposite end of the spectrum, like Mahler's pieces were too long that no one could comprehend them. Webern's pieces were too short and atonal that no one understood them.
Yeah. Cause they'd be like, oh, like I gotta go get a snack. I gotta go to the bathroom. I gotta get some cereal. Like, and then by the time they get back to the theater, the fucking piece is over. You know, I mean, they were like, oh, I'll go out during the introduction. I'll come back when the movement's over. And then they come back and the whole show is over, you know? So it's like, It's interesting because you really have to be there, be present for it. It demands presence and attention. And also, his music is so short that it just seems to exist in just like...
Wait, are we talking about Webern now or Schoenberg?
Oh, I'm sorry. I kind of got into Webern a bit.
Okay. Just wait one second.
Sorry about that.
No, that's fine. Kenzie, you got anything on Schoenberg for us?
Well, no, I think like just in terms of serialism, I think that it was... You know, I love serialism as a musician, but it kind of does create that like white pillar of not being able to have it be easily accessible to people who don't understand music. So I feel like that's where my personal conflict comes from, is that it was designed in opposition of pop music. It was designed in opposition of that genre. So when I think about it and I think about the time of like jazz, blues, like all the other stuff that was going on, could be wrong. This is all coming from the top of my head, but like it feels like it was designed in opposition of that. And I think upon analysis, I can appreciate it. But upon like, you know, a first like listen where music happens and it goes away, where like art, you can examine it, language, you can like see it, examine it. Music is very much like... it happens and then it goes away and then it's the next second, the next moment. It feels harder to digest as the average person. You really have to like know your shit to be able to appreciate it, which is my personal conflict with Schoenberg, which is I love it in the fact that I love how it just kind of releases you from tonality and you're able to really just play with all the timbres and the textures and that type of thing. But if I put myself in the shoes of an average listener, like, sounds like trash. Or just, like, sounds, like, completely undigestible. So I think...
No, that's a perfectly valid viewpoint. And gives me a great into my last quote I want to read, or the last thing I want to read about Schoenberg, where Richard Truskin, this musicologist, says... he commits a poetic fallacy, the conviction that what matters most or all that matters in a work of art is the making of it, the maker's input, and the listener's pleasure must not be the composer's primary objective. Mm-mm. Which I think is like, that's the big problem with it. Like what you just said, Kenzie, that it doesn't sound quote unquote good. And the emphasis is placed on like oh my god the emphasis is placed on the construction, like and this is the trap that I fall into as a composer, where like for me, what if I think I wrote a good piece of music, it's a piece that has rules and like the construction of the piece can be documented like every step of the way. Like it's not about how it sounds as a listener or how it feels to perform. It's like it's that the construction of the piece is the art in itself and not the like aural output, which is in my case wrong and bad because it's neither constructed well nor sounds good. But that's I think that's like anyways.
Okay. Well, that's not entirely true on Max's part. I think his music sounds great and I like it.
You're really nice, Nick. I love you. Okay. Okay. So, oh, actually there is one more quote I want to read.
Oh, please, please, please.
As a segue to the, segments on Berg and Webern. Books. Oh, Nick, do a stand-up bit.
Okay. Is it a space blanket because it's used in space or because it's space efficient? This is a question. Not really a bit, I guess, but it's a funny observation.
Wait, is it used in space?
I don't know. You know what I'm talking about? Those silver blankets that they give the marathon runners? think it's called Space Blankets, right?
Yes. I don't know. I've never run a marathon. I never have any desire to.
Yeah, same.
Yeah.
Here's another question. Oh, go ahead, Max. Let's get back to the show.
All right. So this is after the premiere of Girl Eater in Vienna. So at this point, Schoenberg had premiered other pieces at which riots had broken out and fists were thrown, and the public generally didn't like him. But I'm going to include a clip from Girl Eater, and this quote is he's writing after that premiere. As usual, after this tremendous success, I was asked whether I was happy, but I was not. I was rather indifferent, if not a little angry. I foresaw that this success would have no influence on the fate of my later works. Fuck. I had, during these 13 years, developed my style in such a manner that, to the ordinary concert goer, it seemed to bear no relation to all preceding music. This is true. I believe that. That's a sidebar for me. Continuing with Schoenberg, I had to fight for every new work I had been blah, blah, blah. I stood alone against a world of enemies. And this is the important part. Alone with one exception. That small group of faithful friends, my pupils, among them my dear friend Anton von Webern, the spiritual leader of the group, a very hotspur in his principles, a real fighter, a friend whose faithfulness can never be surpassed, a real genius as a composer. Nick, this is how I would describe you as a friend if I were, like, a Schoenberg-style person. I would use all those words to describe you. A real fighter, a friend whose faithfulness can never be surpassed, a real genius as a composer. That's true.
Wow. Well, thank you, Max.
Fuck you. Going on. He is today recognized the world over among musicians, although his works at the present time have not yet become familiar to the great audiences as his genius deserves.
Hmm.
Also true. Among them also was Alban Berg, one of the dearest to me, Kenzie, one of the dearest to me, whose death we deplored in 1935. Thank God you're still here. He gained worldwide fame through his opera Wozzeck, which was played in every important musical center. He, too, was a most faithful friend to me. There were and still are many others of reputation among them. It was a fact. Whatever. The rest doesn't matter. The point is that... Okay, now we're going to take a break. I got to pee. I got to get another beer. But... That serves as the segue into the segments on Webern and Berg. Kenzie and Nick, love you guys so much. As much as Schoenberg loved Berg and Webern, let's take a quick break and get back to it.
Deep.
Really fucking hot. Yeah, I'm a very cold weather climate person.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been a struggle to adjust, but we're getting there. Yeah, like 90 degrees feels comfortable now, whereas it wouldn't have before. Yeah.
Before we go to Webern and Berg,
mm-hmm.
can I say one more thing?
Mm-hmm.
Please.
Okay, sorry. I know I've talked so too much this time, but the period we're talking about is known as Fin de siècle Vienna, end of the century Vienna, and it's really funny that they chose that, like, the French words are used to describe the end of the century Vienna. Also, another really funny thing is that Schoenberg hated the French so much, and his publishing company is called Belmont, which is like, oh my god. Okay, so Schoenberg in German means beautiful mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And his publishing company, Belmont, in French means beautiful mountain.
Uh-huh.
So fucked up.
Wow.
I mean, it's pretty wild. Anyways, yeah.
The period we're talking about, Fin de siècle Vienna, is arguably like the greatest moment of cultural like explosion in the West since the 5th century before BCE in Athens. Like in Vienna at this time, there's like Mahler's conducting there. There's Schoenberg, Berg, Webern in music. That's enough for one city for like all eternity for it to claim greatness. But in the visual arts, like Klimt is there and he's starting the Vienna Secession. Egon Schiele is there. The architects, Joseph Hoffmann, Otto Wagner are there. Like, it's just an absolute, like, I don't know. It's just such a fascinating period.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the period of, like, the, like, turn of the century Vienna right before World War I is so fascinating to me. I don't know why.
Yeah.
But anyways, let's move on. Who wants to start? Berg or Webern?
Let's see. I'll talk about Webern, if that's okay.
Yeah, okay, cool. Nick,
perfect.
Get after it.
He's born in 1883. His friends called him Tony. And I think...
Is that true?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah,
Tony is a German name.
Oh yes, I'm pretty sure. Let me just
Hey Tony, hey Tony, you gotta write some fucking serialisms.
Tony Webb. That's what his friends called him. So here's
Tony 12-tone Webb.
Here is some interesting stuff about Webern. He was a student of Schoenberg, like Max mentioned in his quote, and Schoenberg thought really, really highly of him. Webern was pretty much obscure, like his whole career. Like people didn't really know his compositions all that well. He didn't have a lot of compositions, and his compositions were also really short. He loved the fact that, well, let me back up and just say that he was, interestingly enough, an authority on Renaissance polyphony. His doctoral thesis was had to do with like transcribing music from like the Renaissance or something, or like renotating it with like modern notation practices. So he had a really deep understanding of Renaissance music. And
that's what's so interesting about these guys, is that they felt such a deep connection to the past that Webern wrote his thesis on music that was like 400 years old to him.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And then he also really loved Mahler and like
obviously
like other, he just loved, he loved German composers. So he loved all of this music that has these massive like monumental like structures and huge development. Meanwhile, Webern doesn't have development intentionally. By design, he puts all of the important musical structures or all of the important musical content that defines the piece just right, he just launches right into it with no introduction. Mm-hmm. And it almost, I forget who said this, but his music almost is infinitely condensed into one moment. It's just a moment, like a piece of, it's almost like a just a little piece of architecture, and you just, and it can go on for it can go on forever, or it can just
yes yes
yeah. So he was a swinging cat, and he knew his shit. But you know, so what I was saying before is that he was pretty obscure. People didn't really know him, but it didn't stop him from like writing this really, really like high level of artistry. Like every piece was highly detailed, and he there was so much thought and structure and complexities that went into his work. And like we were saying before, people like heard it in the concert hall and they were like, okay, well, I don't get it. Can you play it again? But you know, there's no recordings. There's no, you can't put a record on and listen to it again. A lot of his movements were like 30 seconds. He has a really famous piece, for cello and piano. It's Opus 11. And the second movement of that is one that I recommend people check out first if they don't know Webern at all. That's a really good movement. And it's 30 seconds, but you could study it for months and dissect it. And there's so much going on there.
He wrote a set of variations for piano, mm-hmm. That are really awesome. And I think are potentially like the most written about pieces of music of all time. It's like, the most written about pieces of music of all time are the Webern piano variations, Mozart 40th Symphony in G minor, mm-hmm. and like Beethoven 5 or something like that. Uh-huh. Shit. But yeah, each movement lasts like 45 seconds, but it has been grounds for generations of theorists to write about.
Yeah, and then a couple other things I want to say about Webern. let me give you all a couple pieces to listen to. I recommend listening to his Opus 1 for orchestra, which is a really interesting little, it's a cool piece. I wouldn't even start with that, though. I would start with, like I said, I think the Opus 11, the pieces for cello and piano. I think it's three movements. Mm-hmm. It's a perfect little, what is Webern about? Listen to that little piece. I also recommend the quartet Opus 22 for violin, clarinet, tenor sax, and piano, which Max and I played at Crane.
And we did play that.
Yep, and it's a really sick piece. And I'm a saxophone player,
I forgot all about that.
So I really like that piece. It's a really, really great piece.
Let me ask you a question real quick, Nick. Is that a normal thing for saxophone to be included there?
No.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Do you want to talk about a little bit about saxophone in chamber groups and stuff, or the history of saxophone in classical music?
Sure. Yeah. Saxophone in classical music started to come up a little bit more around like 1850, 1860. Composers who knew Adolf Sax, would write pieces for him. There's a really famous piece by Carl Florio for a saxophone quartet. That's kind of like the first major saxophone quartet. But actually, he was like from New York, that guy. That guy was not, from Europe. But there are some other... saxophone has a very, really bad rep. But I think some people started to use saxophone a little bit. I know Berg wrote some saxophone parts in his music.
Yeah.
Also, my main motherfucker, Berlioz, right? He wrote,
yeah.
I think some of his later music was actually scored for wind band, and he wrote saxophone into the parts. So, you know, some people are recognizing it, but it largely doesn't exist in a lot of the music.
But Webern liked it.
Webern liked it. He was hip to it because he was cool.
Let me ask you a question. Is there a difference between, so Adolf Sax was Belgian?
Yeah.
Or Dutch?
Belgian.
And
I like that you sigh every time. Oh, God. As if it's some surprise.
It is the surprise. Every minute I feel like I'm on a roll. Okay. But, so if both Berg and Webern, so I associate Adolf Sax, especially the way he spelled his name, Adolphe, mm-hmm. with a French thing. Is there any differentiation between the way the French felt about the saxophone and the Germans felt, and the German Austrians felt about the saxophone?
I don't think so. I think a lot of German composers are more traditional and were writing in more of a symphonic style, whereas French composers like Darius Milhaud wrote saxophone into a lot of his music. He has a saxophone concerto.
Yeah.
A lot of French composers in this time period were writing for saxophone, whereas German composers were not necessarily, but
Why do you think these guys did?
That is a really good question. Probably just because they are... Well, I think... And this goes back to a couple of things I wanted to say about Weyburn.
Sorry.
I don't know... Huh?
Well, I just said sorry a few times.
Okay. I don't know how many people really were playing his pieces. So maybe he knew a tenor sax player, or he knew some fucking schmuck who had a tenor sax, and he was like, "Hey, I got this piece I'm working on. It was for bassoon, but I don't know any bassoon players, so you're playing it on tenor sax." And so that could very well have happened. Because I mean,
when people ask me like what kind of music I write, I say like I write piano music and I write music for saxophone, and they're like, "Why?" And I'm like, "Well, because." If I want it to be played, either I'm going to have to play it or my best friend is going to have to play it.
My best friend who takes pity on me plays my pieces.
Exactly.
Well, okay. The last thing I want to say about Weyburn is that he has a really tragic death story.
Tell us about it.
Yeah. So in 1945, he was shot by an ally, an allied soldier. I think an American soldier, and he walked out of his house before there was like some kind of curfew in effect in the town that he was living in, and he was shot. He went out to smoke a cigar, and they shot him. And I think it was maybe months after his son was killed in action in World War II. So really tragic. And I'm pretty sure that the American soldier who killed him, it was obviously like, you know, it was an accident, I guess, but like he like sunk into a deep depression, I think, and eventually died like shortly after. I don't know how, but
the American soldier that killed Weyburn came home, found out who Weyburn was, and later killed himself.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And what's so tragic is that Weyburn, like his sister was staying with him, and he only went outside to smoke a cigar to not like upset his nephew or his niece. His sister had had a baby.
Wow.
And he was like, "Well, I don't want to smoke my cigar in here and upset the baby." So he went outside to smoke it and then got shot for that.
Okay. Yeah.
Which reminds me about I forgot to mention Schoenberg's death. He had triskaidekaphobia, fear of the number 13.
Fair.
And he had like a diagnosable fear of it.
He was had a fear of who?
The number 13.
The number 13.
The number 13.
Okay.
So, his whole life he was afraid. He was afraid of the number.
It's a shitty number, to be fair.
Well, it's terrible. He was afraid of it his whole life. And then when he turned 76, a friend of his was like, "Oh, Arnold, 7 + 6 = 13. And he was like, "Holy shit, I never considered adding the digits of my age together to form 13. And then he died like a couple weeks after that. Terrible.
That's pretty fucked.
Pretty fucked. I would say Weyburn's death is more tragic. Schoenberg's death is more astrological.
Right.
Yeah, like self-manifestation.
It was definitely self-manifestation. Self-manifestation. Nick, do you remember Nellie Case talking about Schoenberg's death?
I don't remember much from Nellie Case's
death. I want to know what Nellie Case had to say about Schoenberg's death.
The way she described it was that, like, he was afraid of the number 13. And it was 12:01 a.m. 12 plus which 1 equals is 13.
13. Yeah.
He died.
That was what I remember about her saying that.
I love that woman so much. There is no amount. There is no word to describe how much I love Melly.
Did you take a class with her?
I never even took a class with her. I played an Ani with her.
Okay.
And she talked a lot about Nixon being similar to Donald Trump. And I was like, you know what?
Okay.
It's fine.
Okay. Let me...
Nice.
Nick and I sat next to each other all year.
Big mistake.
In the cases class. Huge mistake. And, okay. First of all, I'm going to shut off the power hour because I officially finished it and I don't want to do another one.
But I will keep drinking.
Okay, but Nellie Case. Oh, she divided the 20th century up into two paths, the neo-romantic or the neoclassic. Do you remember that, Nick?
I just remember I had to take a blue pill or a red pill.
Yeah, you got it. Oh, that's like an alt-right thing.
Oh, really?
That's a Matrix thing.
I thought it was from the Matrix.
It is from the Matrix, but the alt-right adopted that metaphor.
Canceled.
Yeah. Sorry, Nick.
Which pill are you, Nick?
Yeah, you can exit the meeting anytime.
See ya. Sorry. Sorry. I don't know. I don't know. I took them both.
Oh, so you're both sizing this issue.
I do remember this about Nellie Case. There was like the Jedi and the Sith, I think, right?
That's not how she presented it, but if that's what makes sense to you, okay.
That's what helped me pass the test. I didn't pass it.
I don't know how we talked about her, why we were talking about her. But anyways, who are we on now?
Are we on Berg?
Mm-hmm. Maybe
okay.
Can we
take a break?
Quick break?
Yeah.
Yeah, let's take a break.
Break time.
I'm gonna take a break.
We will be right back.
Okay. I will absolutely tell you about Berg. So, homeboy, born February 9th, 1885, Aquarius.
Love it. Yeah.
And he died 35, so he died when he was 50 years old. You know, he was part of the Findy Sickle cultural elite, hung out with, you know, Mahler, Schrecker, Zemlinsky, Klimt, Altenberg, you know, all the guys.
All the cats.
all the major players. So he didn't like do well in school, wasn't very good at much things. And then he found a newspaper ad that Schoenberg was giving. Well, he didn't find it. His brother found it. His brother Conrad found this newspaper ad by Schoenberg advertising for composition lessons. So Schoenberg was doing the grind, being like, okay, I'll teach you how to compose shit. Mm-hmm. And so Berg, well, Conrad, his brother, took him up on that. And so he sent him secret, like, compositions of Berg. And then Schoenberg took him as a student. And then, so, yeah, Berg was Schoenberg's student, mostly for free, but at some point he did pay a modest fee. I guess is what Wikipedia is telling me. telling me for composition lessons from Schoenberg. And he wasn't very popular in his early career. Schoenberg set up a performance of all of his students, and when Berg performed like some of his like, two pieces of his like poet postcard, I think it's what it was called, like his postcard suite, everyone booed, and then the police had to be called. Yeah, it wasn't a good time. Yeah, and then Berg took a major hit to his self-esteem. Didn't feel great about that. And then he fought in World War One, and then he wrote Wilczek on the Leave, and that kind of propelled him in his career.
What's Wilczek?
Wilczek. Wait, Wilczek, you ask?
Oh, yeah.
It's an opera. Yeah, so it's his first opera that he wrote. It's based on the German playwright George, or I guess it would be Georg Büchner. Berg just wrote about it, and it was depicts the everyday lives of soldiers and townspeople, you know, themes of militarism, callousness, exploitation, sadism, casual sadism.
Casual
sadism. And it was his first opera, and it's kind of the thing that propelled him into being more publicly popular. In terms of Schoenberg, in comparison to Schoenberg and Weinberg, he's the more tonal human of these.
There are letters from Berg to Schoenberg after the premiere of Wilczek where Berg is saying like, teacher, I'm so sorry they like this as much as they do. Like, you're the real master.
I didn't specifically read those letters, but I mean, I think like he did deviate from Schoenberg's way a lot, in that he pulled a lot from the first Viennese school, as well as Romanticism, where he tried to make things a little more tonal, and he played with that idea, whereas Schoenberg and perhaps Webern, I don't know anything about Webern, I'm sorry.
There's this general way of conceptualizing these three composers on like the left-right political spectrum, where Schoenberg is essentially a centrist, and he's saying like, listen, this is just my job to push music a little bit further. But when you listen to Schoenberg's music, it does sound romantic, and it sounds a little bit like music from the past, but a little less tonal. And Webern is like the radical leftist, is where they would put him. And his music does not sound like any music that's ever been written before. And Berg's music, Kenzie, like you said, is like more romantic. It's the most approachable in terms of,
for sure,
like introducing people to post-tonal
and he like
classical music.
He structured a lot of his tone rows. So for those who don't know, a tone row is the 12th tone of whatever a composer decides, and that's what they base tonality on instead of a key signature. But he based a lot of his tone rows on triads, which was not a typical thing of 12 tone composers. So his did sound more euphonic than other people.
That's kind of cool, because like some 12 tone kind of like intentionally avoids triads, but he like kind of leans into it, which is kind of cool.
Yeah,
it's kind of sick, actually.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, and he also like pulled from Wagner and Mahler too. Like, he used like leitmotifs from Mahler, and he quoted a lot of Bach. He quoted a lot of folk songs. Like, he was consistently just doing his own thing, because he never like went to formal training. He was more doing his own thing with Schoenberg, and then he deviated from that a little bit. But
that's cool.
Yeah. So he learned from Schoenberg, basically had that riot, fought in World War One, wrote Wilczek, and that's kind of when the public were, you know, stands. Stands for Berg. And so basically what I'm here to talk about is the Berg Violin Concerto, which I played with Max on my final jury at Crane, which Max forced me to learn
it's true.
Against my will, but it was a great experience.
Oh, okay.
What were you gonna say?
I just don't want anything out there saying I forced anyone to do anything against their will.
No, but it was in a good way. It was in a way of growth. So I think that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Like I'm not like, oh, dang, Max forced me to learn this violin concerto. Because you also had to learn some like shitty shit by Ravel. Yeah.
But my like. I was working with Kenzie as an accompanist, and I really wanted to learn the Berg Violin Concerto. And I knew Kenzie was cool and that she would also want to play it. So I was like, let's learn this piece that no one else in Crane is ever going to play.
I just wanted the shock value. Like, I wanted to go into my last jury and, like, fuck up some professors.
Yes.
I think that was my main motive.
That's the main goal.
Yeah, the main goal is so that, like, they don't have anything to say because you've just played something that, like, no one else in that school would be able to do. Yeah.
Doesn't know a single fucking note in the band.
No. I mean, he would say would be, like, play with all your fingers.
What's so depressing about academia is that was washed up when Nick and I were students there. And then 10 fucking years later, he's still washed up when Kenzie's a student there in his studio.
Yeah.
He doesn't know what the fucking Berg Violin Concerto sounds like.
No. Wow. No, I think I gave it to him and he was like, good luck. And I was like, all right. And if you're listening to this, you should have retired 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Boom, roasted.
My dude.
But anyways, so yeah, the Berg Violin Concerto was actually the last piece that Berg wrote. So this violinist, Krosner, he tried to commission it from Berg. Just like this was before it was dedicated to anyone, which we'll talk about later. But he tried to commission this piece and Berg was like, nah, dude, I'm like so hung up on this opera Lulu. So he was in the weeds with Lulu.
Mm. And Lulu's awesome, by the way.
Mm-hmm. Which is really awesome and uncompleted because he wrote this violin concerto. And then finally, like after, so this concerto was dedicated to Alma Mahler, her daughter, died of polio. So not Mahler's daughter, but her, what is it? Gropius? That was her husband, Walter Gropius. And Krosner actually commissioned Berg to write this concerto prior to Alma Mahler's daughter passing. But what solidified like the dedication to it was the passing of her daughter from polio. So, and I think Louis Krosner, he commissioned it for $1,500, which is like $30,000 in today's money. Okay. So, technical difficulties, but as I was saying, $1,500, $30,000. A lot of money.
Tons.
Yes. So, that ultimately convinced Berg to put aside Lulu and write the violin concerto. And then, it happened at the same time when Alma Mahler's daughter died. Was sort of at the same time as he was commissioned to write this violin concerto. And then after that happened, he offered to dedicate it to the memory of an angel, which is Alma Mahler's daughter.
It's is it Alma's daughter with Gropius?
Yep.
It's
not
Alma's daughter with Gustav.
No. No. Okay. I don't think they have any kids. But yeah, it was with Gropius.
Mahler and Alma definitely had kids.
Maybe. I don't know. You didn't ask me to research that, so I'm not sure.
That's a fact, that they had two kids. At least, they had two daughters. And,
didn't they have Mahler, they had a son, too, right?
Maybe.
Oh, wow. None of us know anything. Well, actually, maybe Nick knows everything. It's just me and Ken's life.
Yeah, but I don't know anything.
Like, I don't know. Alma and Gustav had two kids, and then Gustav wrote the Kinder Totenlieder, the songs on the death of children, and Alma was like, why would you do that? Now our kids are going to die. And then at least one of them died after that.
Yeah.
From scarlet fever, maybe?
And then Alma...
But anyways, yeah.
Yeah.
Gustav and Alma had kids.
Yeah, they had kids, but... This concerto was not concerning any of their kids. It was
Alma and
Gropius. Yeah, it was Manon. I think her name was her name was Manon for sure. Maybe, maybe. A quick Google will do the trick. You let me know. Yeah, it's Manon. And yeah, so then he wrote this concerto in 3 months, and he wrote it across the lake of where Brahms were his violin concerto. Ooh. So he went to the summer house and
love it,
wrote it. But
didn't they play, they played ice hockey on that lake, right?
AirPods died. We may have to take a break. Audio issues aside, Berg, he decided to write the concerto. His dedication was to Alma Mahler's daughter, and he wrote it in 3 months on the beach of, I don't remember, but it was across...
Yeah, you know what?
What?
I feel like if I had a beach to write on for 3 months, I could write a violin concerto too.
Yeah.
This shit is bougie as shit. I gotta go to fucking work at a bookstore.
Yeah, it wasn't so bad. Yeah,
wasn't so bad.
It wasn't so bad. But he did put off the composition of Lulu. So the violin concerto is his last like complete written work, and Lulu is unfinished, right? So,
Lulu's really good, though.
Yeah, Lulu's pretty good. Lulu's
an opera, by the way, for those who don't know.
But yeah, so he died from an insect bite, which is pretty wild. Yeah, he died in 1935, before the concerto ever even premiered. He just, he had like an insect bite, and they didn't have modern medicine, so they just like fucking... We're like, too bad, so sad, you know? You're going to be done so at the age of 50.
It's really too bad.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Berg was awesome. Mm-hmm. I played his piano sonata at my grad recital.
Nice.
Yeah. He was a cool guy.
He lifted it straight from Liszt. He was awesome.
Yeah.
When I won a scholarship at NEC, where I did my master's.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to give a concert for the people who gave me the scholarship. And I played the Berg Sonata for them. And at the end, they were like, these were like ancient, like 80 or 90-year-old women. They were like, could you play something a little softer? Can I just play the piece I played? I'm sorry, it was too loud.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But yeah, so like, I mean, Berg was the most tonal.
It's all disco, man.
Yeah, the most tonal of the Second Viennese School.
Mm.
He taught from Schoenberg. He learned from Schoenberg.
Check. Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hello?
Hmm. Check. No, we're good. I'm just muted for whatever reason, but I'll unmute myself. Okay. Yeah. So that's all about Berg and his origin story.
Love it.
Yeah. Wrote it in 3 months. It's in 2 movements, but 4 sections. His tone row, which for the listeners is, you know, the amount of 12 tones, which is exists in music, is based on triads. So it's based on the G minor triad, the D major triad, the A minor triad, and then a whole tone scale. Cool. So, So it's the most tonal. But yeah, so in his concerto, yeah, he quoted from like all these open string triads. So that was like the big thing was open strings. Mm-hmm. And like if you think about like the big five, so the big five in violin land is Tchaikovsky, D major, open string. Brahms, D major, open string. Beethoven, D major, fucking open string, yes.
You're talking concertos?
Yeah, we're talking about concertos. And Sibelius, D minor, still open string. And Mendelssohn, E minor, which is still open string. And even, like, Mozart, all of his like, big three, G, D, and A, were all open strings. So he built this tone row of a G minor triad, D minor triad, E major triad, and then some other open string. There's more, but I can't think about it right now. But, yeah, so it was on par with that. And when I learned this, I was surprised at how idiomatic it was to the instrument, which I think was unlike any other post-tonal music that I learned before, because it did feel good under my fingers, which was, which was really different.
Schoenberg doesn't care about that at all.
Gives like, no shit. Schoenberg's
shits. Music on piano is so uncomfortable. And Webern's too. But Berg is, you're right, Kenzie, that he managed to write the music that was both experimental and idiomatic. That felt good on the instrument.
Yeah, and I think he like wanted to make it that way too, because it was commissioned for a violinist. And I think when playing it, I think at first it was very daunting, but then once I got to play all of it, it was not easy, but it was manageable in the way that other concertos of that caliber had felt.
Right. I kind of admire that, though, because you're going to end up having really nice performances of your works when you write... when you write comfortable music to play, right? And it's going to sound like, if you have a vision for that, right? That's why, like, sometimes I took some composition lessons over the past couple years, and sometimes I'll have an idea that I'm like, oh man, I have this idea, but it's like, I really want to, I want to like write it for a particular instrument. But then I realize that once I have that idea, I should think about more about like what is the characteristic of an instrument and what would match how would that idea match that instrument, you know, as opposed to just being like, oh, I want to write some shit for saxophone and then just write something that doesn't fit at all on the instrument, you know? I think that I admire that about Berg.
Berg wrote for saxophone.
Yeah. My man, Albie.
One of the few.
Like his first, like the introduction to the Berg Violin Concerto is, I think, pretty sure, like after the violin plays the initial thing.
Yeah.
Is saxophone. I'm pretty sure imitates it.
I think so.
There's alto sax part.
Because.
Yeah, no, there for sure is an alto sax part.
But it's because the Belgian dude, Adolf Sax, invented the sax. The French hated it, and the Germans were like, what can we do to piss off the French? Yeah.
That's right.
Nick, how much French saxophone music is there around this time versus how much German, Austrian saxophone music there is.
Oh, there's definitely more French music, for sure.
Okay, I take back what I said. The Germans were the ones who don't know what's going on.
They don't know shit.
I mean, yeah, well, did you ever hear about, like, the Franco-Prussian War of, like, what, 1912?
Technically, I've heard of it.
Okay.
I don't know.
Well, it lasted, it lasted a year.
Okay.
And they essentially, like, the Ottoman Empire, like, surrounded Paris.
Mm.
And this was, like, a huge thing for, like, Debussy, where it was this idea of, like, nationalism. And I think that's pretty relevant today of whether or not you take the art for the art or contemplate the art for the artist, of whether you can appreciate the art that's made or whether or not it's coming from the artist. So the Franco-Prussian War, so the Ottoman Empire surrounded the zoo. Well, no, all of Paris. And then they ate the zoo. So they had, like, giraffe soup or, like, cats and rats was a dish that they had.
What?
Yeah, pretty fucking wild. So then, like, music of French people came out of, like, are we going to follow the Germans or are we going to do our own thing?
Right.
Which was the main thing of that.
Oh my God. I feel like there's a lot of stuff I don't know about that.
Well, Nick, there might be a lot of stuff you don't know about a lot of things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, insult me.
What does that M stand for on your hat? That's not an insult. That's just a question.
Micro? Oh. It stands for Milwaukee.
Oh.
No.
Oh.
It stands for Minnesota.
Oh, that's where you live.
That's where I live.
What is Minnesota like?
It's pretty flat. I live at the highest natural point in Minnesota.
Your apartment?
Yeah.
Holy shit, that must be really high.
Yeah, well, no. But I have a fixed gear bike, so it seems like it's really high because every time I have to ride my bike home from anywhere, I have to ride to the highest point in the state.
Is Austin flat, Kenzie?
Austin, it depends. So there's, like, caves and caverns.
Caves? There are caves in Austin?
Other than that, it's pretty flat, yeah.
Cool.
So the altitude in Austin is negative.
It's about, like, yeah, it's about, like, 700, yeah, it's about, like, 700 feet. It's not crazy.
Underground?
Yeah, but there is, like, comparatively to Texas, there's more trees, I guess.
Yeah. Wait, Kenzie, do you play viola too? Or is it mainly violin is your thing?
Mainly violin is my thing, but I have played viola.
Is it, like, really hard to play the viola if you are a professional violinist and you play violin all the time?
It's hard to read the clef.
Oh, fuck that clef.
I think, like, it's, like, so I have, like, a couple of viola students, so it's, like, if I'm in viola mode for the day, then I can, like, do that.
Okay, right.
But
on. Right on.
No, it's not that hard to play viola, which is why a lot of violinists will shift to viola clef.
Okay. Yeah, I know a guy who plays viola, but he was a violinist for a long time, but then he switched and now he plays viola all the time.
There's less competition for viola, I will say that.
I mean, viola's kind of sick, though. It's got that low C string, right?
Yeah. It's super cool. There's a lot of great concertos.
Yeah.
But I am hip
to viola.
Yeah, I'm hip to viola too, for sure. But it is, like, yeah.
Do you play any non-classical music on violin?
I play a lot of fiddle music, specifically of, like, Kepa K.
You want to play some right now?
Right now?
Yeah, play some.
I could. But I'm a little fucking drunk. I do have my violin.
That's the show.
But yeah, so like KBK fiddling is like you do a lot of foot tapping. But that's something the thing that I learned over the pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Was how to do that. But like that's how I started violin was fiddling, and then my fiddle group disbanded. And then I learned
that's tragic.
Through Suzuki, which is like the main way.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll try to remember some fiddle songs.
Cool.
I don't know if I remember. I guess I'll find out. But let me see if I remember.
Yes.
Sick. That sounds amazing.
I love it.
I don't know. I feel like I'm really fucking drunk. Wait, hold on.
Do you know the Wild Rover?
What's a Wild Rover?
I don't know. I thought it was a fiddle tune. I don't know what I'm talking about.
It probably is, but I don't know.
I love it. It sounds amazing.
That's cool.
Thank you, Nick, for being so kind.
Are you serious? That sounds fucking great. I want to. Oh man, I wish I played the fiddle. That sounds so good.
Man, it's a cool thing to know. Yeah, for sure. But I'm trying to think.
Four strings are the exact right amount of strings. I feel like five is too many. Three is not enough. Four strings is all you need, right?
Four strings is all you need. Sure.
Okay. Listen, guys.
Yeah.
That was awesome, Kenzie.
I don't know. I feel like you're pandering. I feel like I'm being really drunk.
Yes.
This is what violin concerto should be
about. That's rock and roll,
everybody,
baby.
Everybody just, yeah. Okay. Hang in there.
Has digressed.
Okay.
From the what? Second Viennese school.
Second Viennese school.
To another school that's awesome.
Mm.
But I think we should call it there. Kenzie, thank you so much for being here and talking to us about Berg and playing some Berg for us and playing some fiddle for us.
Awesome.
You sound great.
Awesome. You rock, Kenzie.
Kenzie.
I didn't play anything for you. Please don't include any of that into your recording. Okay. I will send you tracks.
Here's what happens, Kenzie. I press record, and then I press stop, and then I press publish. So all that stuff's going to be in there.
Okay, perfect. I'm really great at violin. I have a master's degree.
Yeah, you do.
Master's.
Okay. Thank you for joining us about early modernist serialism. Kenzie, you got anything to plug? You got a teacher Instagram or something like
no,
that?
No, I have no things to plug. Yeah, no, I'm chilling.
Ah, that's cool.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much. We'll see you next time.
See you next time.
All right. See you next time. Well, I'll listen.